If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Spectrum Business works with small businesses nationwide, so we know that running your own business means doing it all. Marketing, sales, inventory, customer service, and more. Spectrum One for Business helps you keep it all connected for just $49.99 a month. Get fast, reliable internet, advanced Wi-Fi with Security Shield, and a free mobile line for one low price. Stay connected and do it all with Spectrum One for Business. Only $49.99 a month. Go to spectrum.com/business to learn more. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin underwear. The luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Shop Tommy John's Friends and Family Sale right now and get 25% off site-wide at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
I think that we just have to accept that there is an inherent violence about settler colonialism, that, you know, it, ultimately the settler colonial idea was about not recognising the validity of other cultures.
That was Tom Lawson talking about the effects of the British Empire.
The earliest art ever found in Egypt, which is pecked on the rocks overlooking the Nile, is of fishing equipment. And it shows that from the dawn of time, people have not only used the Nile, but they've celebrated the bounty of the Nile.
And that was Toby Wilkinson on the historic importance of the River Nile. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast. My name is Charlotte Hodgman and I'm features editor of BBC History Magazine, the UK's best-selling history title. You can find the magazine in all good newsagents or you can take out a subscription from anywhere in the world. See historyextra.com/subscribe-today for our latest subscription deals. We also have digital editions available for the iPad, Kindle, Kindle Fire, Google Play and Zinio. To find out more about all of these digital formats, head to historyextra.com/digital. We've also recently launched on Kobo. You'll find us under the e-magazine section on Kobo.com. The treatment of other cultures during the expansion of the British Empire has long been a controversial subject. In his new book, Professor Tom Lawson from Northumbria University explores the often brutal experiences of the people of Tasmania. He spoke to books editor Matt Elton about his research and how he hopes it may add to our understanding of the Empire Project.
So what first led you to write this book?
Well, it's quite a kind of sort of serendipitous story, really. I've mainly worked previously as a historian of the Holocaust, and I'd written a book about the way in which the Holocaust was represented in history writing. And then as a consequence of my being an editor of a journal called Holocaust Studies, we produced a special edition of that journal called The Memory of the Holocaust in Australia. And producing that got me to thinking about how odd it was, in a way, that we were talking about the memory of a particular genocide, in this case the Holocaust, in a space that was itself you know, had itself witnessed genocide in terms of the treatment of indigenous populations there. So in a sense, that's what led me then to think about genocide in Tasmania, and then links to myself, really, I guess, in terms of thinking about the kind of memory of that genocide in Britain, and how Britain had either dealt or not dealt with its kind of genocidal past in terms of the colonisation of Australia.
Mm. I mean, this is, of course, a genocide that hasn't received much coverage, or has been perhaps in some way forgotten, which we'll touch on in a minute. But it does mean that I think maybe listeners won't know much about the events we're talking about. So when are we talking about? What kind of period and what happened?
Okay, so the British established a colony in Tasmania, on the island of Tasmania, a colony that they called Van Diemen's Land in 1803 and 1804. It was largely to function as a penal colony. And over the first period of the colonisation, there were exchanges of violence between the British settlers and an indigenous population on Tasmania that probably amounted to, we don't really know how many, but we probably amounted to somewhere between 8,000 and 12,000 people. I think the best estimates at the moment are probably around 9,000 people that were there when the British arrived. In the 1820s, so sometime after that original colonisation, relations between the indigenous population and the settlers became more and more violent, ending in effectively a period of conflict in the middle part and latter part of the 1820s, which was known contemporaneously as the Black War. Largely that happened in the 1820s because by that stage the colony had grown to such an extent that indigenous peoples were being forced from their land, and indeed their existence was being threatened simply by their inability to use the land in the way in which they had done previously. So that Black War led to large amounts of deaths of indigenous people, and of course there were also deaths by disease. By the end of the 1820s, the indigenous population had actually declined to just really a few hundred. At that point, the indigenous peoples effectively, although indigenous population in Tasmania was not a unitary singular population, it was actually probably arranged into up to nine different nations or different ethnic linguistic and cultural groups. But the largest surviving cultural groups then at that point decided to effectively seek an agreement with the settlers. That agreement was reached, but one of the consequences of that was that the colonial government sought then to remove the surviving population of what we would now call Tasmania, and those people who had survived the conflict were deported to an outlying island called Flinders Island, which is about 40 miles, I think, off the coast of Tasmania, where they were where they lived then in a settlement that was known to the indigenous population as Wyvalenna. And on that settlement, that population then declined to the point where by the mid-1840s, there were just 47, I think, survivors who were then at that point sent back to a disused penal station on Tasmania, where the population further declined. The last quote unquote Tasmanian man died in the early part of the 1860s, and the last woman, Truganini, died in 1876. That's a slight misnomer in the sense that the British themselves constructed this idea that they had, as it were, exterminated the entire indigenous population. That's not entirely true in the sense that there were indigenous people who, children of relationships between settlers and indigenous peoples who survived. And of course, there is a Tasmanian Aboriginal community today that has a direct lineage to those people. But as far as the British were concerned, by 1876, there were no indigenous peoples left on Tasmania.
I mean, that's fairly horrific treatment in quite a short space of history. What's the established view of who caused this, what happened and why it happened? And then how does your study kind of differ from this, I guess?
The difficulty, I guess, is in demonstrating, in terms, if we're talking about, you know, how people died, it's difficult to demonstrate how many people died through, for example, violence between settlers on the frontier and indigenous peoples. I mean, this was a war in a sense that the indigenous people were defending their land and doing so themselves with some violence, and certainly settlers in Van Diemen's Land in the 1820s were afraid, and indeed thought that there was a threat to the very kind of survival of the colony. So, but in terms of the numbers, it's not clear how many people died through violence, how many people died through disease. So, for example, those people who were taken to Wyberlenna, all of those died ultimately through disease, and that in a sense it's not entirely clear you know, where one might apportion some sort of responsibility for that. In terms of the violence, the settlers themselves, individual settlers, were certainly the most exterminationist, if you use that phrase. I mean, in the sense that it was settler communities that wished to kind of that thought that the indigenous population represented an existential threat to them, and there you certainly find people talking in terms of extermination. The colonial government didn't talk in those terms at all, and sought to try and control, or in its terms, sought to kind of control the violence. But it often did that in a way that exacerbated violence. So, for example, you know, proclamations of martial law. So there was a kind of rhetoric of controlling the violence, but at the same time, there was a legitimation of that violence. And then the colonial government, the colonial office in London, sorry, the British government, certainly set their stall against the notion that the indigenous population should be exterminated. They were very clear that that shouldn't be the case. But at the same time, there's a certain that's slightly misleading, in that they also stated very clearly that the first responsibility of the colonial government, and indeed the settler population, was to defend the colony. And indeed, they were also utterly committed to the development of the colony, which was ultimately, after all, the root cause of the conflict. But the in terms of the removal of the population to Flinders Island or Wyberlenna, there the idea was, in effect, that these people would be transformed somehow. They would be rendered into kind of European peasants. They would be taught, in inverted commas, how to farm the land in a British way. They would be taught to worship a Christian god. They would be taught about the notion of commerce. They would, in effect, be quote unquote civilized. And that was, you know, that was a campaign of cultural destruction that certainly the colonial office in London were utterly committed to. And indeed, after there was a point during the 1830s that actually I think the colonial office thought that settlements like that on Flinders Island, where you group together indigenous peoples and you attempted to kind of, as they would have seen it, educate them and show them the benefits of colonization, that at that point became a model for how policy towards indigenous peoples might progress elsewhere in the empire. That didn't last very long, because obviously the population declined, so it was clear that this wasn't clear to the colonial office that this wasn't working. But certainly I think that in terms of, you asked me how my interpretation was different, I think that it's different in the sense that I what I try and investigate throughout is the relationship between violence and the destruction of indigenous peoples and the British government. And I guess what I'm trying to argue is that you have to look beyond the kind of instructions to against violence, to think about where its root causes, and there I think you can apportion a great deal of responsibility to the very idea of the colonial empire itself, and to, in that sense, the representatives of that empire in government.
In terms of then the British government's attitude towards this, is it correct to say that there was an attempt to, if not exterminate these people, then to render their culture in some way obsolete?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there certainly isn't an attempt to, you know, the government in London is absolutely committed to the idea that it should actually protect this population. But what you have to ask is, what does that protection mean? And what protection means is showing them the benefits of colonization. And what that effectively means is a campaign of cultural destruction. There was no sense in which anyone involved in this story saw there being a future for Indigenous peoples within their own cultures on the island of Tasmania. They saw their responsibilities to those peoples as converting them, as I said before, teaching them to farm the land, because they had a whole host of assumptions which suggested that Indigenous peoples were unable to manage the land, which was of course untrue. They did indeed manage the land. They simply moved across it and used different parts of the land at different times of year, and actually had a very complex relationship with their environment, which the British couldn't recognise. But absolutely, they were committed to the extirpation of Indigenous culture. That the Colonial Office would have said, and did indeed argue, that they were also committed to the kind of physical protection of these people from the settlers. But that was quite an interesting idea, because there's a consistency to the way people within the Colonial Office talk about this problem. And it's always in terms of that the problem here is the settlers, that somehow, because of course lots of these settlers were former convicts, that this idea that they had somehow exported the most savage parts of British society, and that they were then they were the root of the problem in terms of the violence with the Indigenous population. But of course, that was a narrative that sort of set the colonial government, and indeed the colonial idea itself, free of any responsibility, because their idea was, well, if this colonialism was effectively being done properly, then the Indigenous people would be brought into its remit and would find their future as colonial citizens. But there was certainly no commitment on the part of anyone involved to actually the Indigenous people surviving within their own culture, if you see what I mean.
Absolutely. I mean, if we're to turn our attention away from the settlers to the figures in government or perhaps society more generally, who can we start to explore in terms of the people behind these events?
Well, I mean, the events take place over a long period of time, so I think that it's difficult to talk about in terms of individuals. I mean, I think that you can see a pretty consistent train of thought running through the Colonial Office, which sets policy towards Indigenous peoples through its relationship with the its colonial governors in the colonies itself. You can also start to look at track some individuals who moved between Britain and the Australian colonies and Tasmania, and who certainly came back to Britain. I mean, the most obvious example being a man called George Augustus Robinson, who was largely personally, in a way, responsible for the gathering together of the Indigenous survivors after the Black War and their deportation to Flinders Island. Because when I say the survivors were taken to Flinders Island, that didn't happen in one go. It took Robinson and indeed his Indigenous guides several years as they toured the island and effectively convinced people to come with them. And Robinson had come to Tasmania in the 1820s. He was a builder, but he was committed to the kind of he was evangelical Christian, and he was committed to what he saw it as the saving of these people. And he went on to then try and perform very similar tasks in other Australian colonies. But ultimately, he came back to Britain, and he's now buried in a graveyard in Bath, where his gravestone bears the extraordinary inscription of George Augustus Robinson, the pacificator of Tasmanian Aborigines, is what it says on his gravestone.
Yeah, okay. I mean, an expanding of obviously the story to the British Empire project more generally, what does this episode tell us about its attitudes towards other cultures, and does it call into question the wider value of the empire?
I think that, you know, I find the sort of balance sheet approach to empire a bit difficult. I mean, I think that all it does for me, and I'm not a historian of the British Empire, and this is, you know, in a sense, was a, you know, something that I discovered for myself in writing the book. I think that we just have to accept that there is an inherent violence about settler colonialism, that, you know, it, ultimately the settler colonial idea was about not recognizing the validity of other cultures. Indeed, it was about the assumption, for example, that the land was empty. Now, this doesn't mean that the authors of Empire genuinely believed the land was empty. It simply means that they didn't believe that it was being used properly, and that these different cultures had no, in a sense, right to it. And I think that that's the reality of the settler colonial empire, was that it was, you know, inherently necessarily destructive. And, you know, we need to engage with that in the way in which we think about the empire in Britain. And I'm not entirely convinced that we do. I mean, I'm aware that I use the term genocide, and I'm convinced of the use of that term, but it's a pejorative term, and I understand that, and I understand that some people will find that difficult. But, you know, if genocide is the destruction of another people, and it's, you know, literally it's the expunging of its culture, then that's what happened here.
And talking about the people to which this happened, what sources, what sense do we get of their side of the story? What kind of sources did you use in the course of your research?
Well, I mean, one of the interesting things about the Tasmanian Indigenous Tasmanian culture is, in a way, the only records that we have for it are the records that are produced by those individuals that are ultimately involved in its destruction. So, the figure I talked about before, Robinson, kept voluminous diaries, which do record aspects of Indigenous culture, which are then kept alive to this day through the present day community. I think that the other thing, and one of the things I was also really interested in, was the degree to which elements of cultural property and indeed ultimately human remains found their way back to Britain and were represented in Britain and continued to be represented up until relatively recently, which I think is also part of the story, really, which is the way in which this story had you know, resonances and echoes a long time after the story itself, in a way, had finished, if you see what I mean.
I mean, let's talk about those echoes, I guess, a bit. Why do you think it's important? Well, I suppose, first of all, why do you think this episode has been kind of largely forgotten?
Well, I think, I mean, the notion of it's being forgotten is a difficult one. I mean, I think if there was someone in Australia who was listening to this, they would say that it hadn't been forgotten at all, and was talked about in Australian society, in wider society, as well as in Australian academia. I think that the interesting thing is that conversation hasn't happened, it seems to me, in Britain, in the sense that we talk about you know, Australia struggles in some ways to come to terms with its kind of genocidal foundations, but there's this notion that that somehow is a story that's nothing to do with Britain, which I think is interesting, and I guess wrong. I think that I guess I would also say that one of the things I was really struck by is that the presence of this story, the continuing presence of this story in British culture. I mean, these newspaper articles are written about the destruction of the Indigenous peoples in Tasmania. The title of the book, The Last Man, comes from a article in the Times that was about the death of William Lanny, the last Indigenous full-blooded, as they would have called it, Indigenous male. There was another article in the Times that was a leader article in the Times that was entitled "We Have Exterminated the Race in Tasmania," or in Van Diemen's Land. Sorry. So there was actually a kind of cultural presence of what happened. It was represented in paintings, in museum displays of, as I say, human remains. Often you would find in variety of museums across Britain the skulls of Indigenous Tasmanians represented in displays of effectively displays of racial hierarchy. And it was usually noted that the Indigenous peoples of Tasmania had been exterminated or had died out in some way. So there was a kind of enduring presence of this story in British culture. I guess it has declined in more recently, but you still found its presence in a variety of places. Represented in museum display, where it still is today. I mean, if you go to there was a collection of Tasmanian artifacts that were sent to a museum in Saffron Walden, which are displayed in a different way now, much more sensitively than they were before, but they're still there. Or similarly, a necklace of Trigonines was on display in until it was returned to the present day Tasmanian Aboriginal community. It was on display in Exeter until the mid 1990s with a kind of caption that talked about the destruction of the people from which Truganini came. So there is a kind of presence of the destruction in British culture, but it's often been explained as a kind of natural process somehow, as this almost caricatured as a kind of Stone Age population, the Indigenous people, that they kind of faded from history, which is of course a kind of obfuscation of what was at periods times of real violence, and you know, at the end was certainly a period of forced ethnic cleansing, which certainly that part of the story perhaps has not resonated.
Sure, no, and we have touched on this briefly before. Do you think it's important that the British people come to terms with the negative side of the empire, and how far do you think this process has already started to happen?
I mean, that's a difficult question to answer, isn't it? Because in a way, it's so politicised. I mean, I think that, you know, if you were to look at the first drafts of the new national curriculum for history when they came out last year or the year before, then you might say that it hasn't started to happen very far. I mean, I think that from my position, as you know, previously and primarily someone who was interested in the Holocaust, I think it's interesting that we in Britain regard genocide, for example, as the, in a sense, the ultimate atrocity, the ultimate transgression. This desire, the idea of kind of expunging another people being a kind of crime against humanity. That we understand that, and yet there's relatively little attention paid to the. The moments of empire where those things happened, and where the British vision of the world did unleash that kind of violence on other parts of the world. So I think that there's a certain disconnect between our willingness to remember the crimes of others in effect and not to think about the violence of empire. So I'm not convinced that there's a great deal of reflection on that kind of part of the, of imperial history in Britain, at the moment, at least.
Fantastic. What message would you hope that readers would take away from this book about this particular genocide?
I think that, you know, I would hope that people engaged with it as a kind of way of looking at genocide, and thinking about the way genocide relates to our own culture in Britain, and to think about the way in which some ideas that we might think of as very normal, like, for example, the notion of progress, which I think is still part of a kind of some visions of some sort of mainstream visions of historical development, that we might think about the violence within that, that actually those there is, those kind of ideas do disguise a violence, and that we have to face up to the fact that you know, that we have a past that is difficult, challenging, and has some difficult issues for people to deal with. And I think that you know, we like to tell ourselves stories about the past that are very comforting, that are very kind of, you know, about British heroism. And all I would say is that, you know, within some of those stories, there are also some really dark moments. And this is one of those.
That was Tom Lawson. Tom's book, The Last Man, A British Genocide in Tasmania, is out now, published by IB Taurus.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin underwear. The luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Shop Tommy John's Friends and Family Sale right now and get 25% off site-wide at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
Oh, such a clutch pickup, Dave.
I was worried we'd bring back the same team.
I meant those blackout motorized shades.
Blinds.com made it crazy affordable to replace our old blinds.
Hard to install?
No, it's easy. I installed these and then got some for my mom, too. She talked to a design consultant for free and scheduled a professional measure and install.
Hall of Fame son.
They're the number one online retailer of custom window coverings in the world.
Blinds.com is the GOAT.
The GOAT.
Go to Blinds.com for up to 45% off. Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Before our next interview, it's time to catch up with the latest history news with our website editor, Emma McFarnan.
A letter of advice on how to be a king sent to the future George III by his father, Frederick, Prince of Wales, is to go on display for the first time. The previously unseen letter, written in 1749, urges the future king to avoid war, ease the tax burden, and not to trust flatterers. It will go on show at the Queen's Gallery, Buckingham Palace, in April as part of a new exhibition titled The First Georgians, Art and Monarchy, 1714 to 1760. George III became heir to the throne on the death of his father in 1751, succeeding his grandfather, George II, in 1760. In other news, the world's oldest known Holocaust survivor has died, aged 110. Alice Hertzsummer, who lived in London, died on Sunday morning. Miss Hertzsummer spent 2 years in a Nazi concentration camp in Theresienstadt after being born into a Jewish family in Prague in 1903. She was a renowned concert pianist who was recently the subject of an Oscar-nominated documentary, The Lady in No. 6, Music Saved My Life. Meanwhile, a lost portrait of Charles Edward Stuart, popularly known as Bonnie Prince Charlie, has been discovered in Scotland. The portrait, which dates to 1745, the year Charles launched his ill-fated invasion of England, was painted by Scottish artist Alan Ramsay. painted in Holyrood Palace, it has for over 250 years remained almost entirely unseen in a collection at Gosford House, just outside Edinburgh. It is the only portrait of Charles to have been painted in Britain.
Thanks for that, Emma. And don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest history news at historyextra.com. Toby Wilkinson is an Egyptologist based at the University of Cambridge. In his latest book, he tells the story of the Nile River, from ancient times up until Egypt's troubled present. Editor Rob Attar spoke to Toby a little while ago about his new book and began by asking him how important he felt the Nile was to the history of Egypt.
The Nile is absolutely essential. I mean, there's this famous quote from Herodotus, the ancient Greek historian, that Egypt is the gift of the river, which is a simple way of saying that without the Nile, there would be no Egypt. I mean, it is essentially the Sahara Desert, and the only thing that brings life to that part of North Africa is the River Nile. So historically and today, all life has depended on the river.
And so clearly, as you said, Egypt wouldn't be possible without the Nile. But is it almost more than that, though? I mean, is it the case that the Nile gave Egypt a head start over the other countries around it that enabled it to be the first great ancient civilization?
Yeah, so the Nile doesn't just make life possible, but it also makes life productive. So because of the particular regime of the River Nile in ancient times, and indeed up to modern times, agriculture in Egypt is incredibly bountiful, and indeed is more productive than in most other parts of the world, certainly other surrounding countries, which meant that from the time that people first settled down to farm in the Nile Valley, they were able to produce not just enough to eat, but enough to provide a surplus. And that immediately gives a society the ability to trade, to engage in what you might think of non-productive activities. In other words, developing a great civilization. And so it really does give Egypt a head start. And of course, the other crucial aspect of the Nile is that it unifies the country. It provides the main means of transport and communication, and means that it's relatively easy in Egypt to communicate and travel between towns and cities, all of which, incidentally, are located by the banks of the Nile. And so from a very early period, Egypt is able to be unified as a single country in a way that, for example, Mesopotamia was not.
Now, the Nile clearly does travel down further than the borders of Egypt. So why was it that the entire Nile region didn't become one country? Why did it stop where Egypt stopped?
It's a good question, and it has largely to do with geography. So from its journey northwards, from its sources in the Ethiopian highlands and in Lake Victoria, as the Nile flows northwards, it encounters a series of obstacles in its path, sort of intrusions of hard rock across the river valley, which cause it to flow through rapids and waterfalls. And they're what we call the Nile cataracts. And they provide quite a barrier to shipping and communication. And it's only when the Nile has, if you like, overcome the final barrier, the first Nile cataract, that it flows uninterrupted down to the Mediterranean Sea. And it's no coincidence that that first Nile cataract coincides with the ancient boundary between Egypt and what was called Nubia, the area to the south. So it's really in the Egyptian Nile that the river takes on its most important characteristics of being easily navigable and a good source of communication. And therefore, in that stretch of the river's valley, that you get a great civilization developing.
In that case, was it not the case that the civilizations further south of Egypt were able to communicate or reach Egypt with the Nile? Was it just not navigable at all?
But they were able to communicate with Egypt, but they never developed the same sort of large-scale unified civilization that occurred further north. So you do get a number of small-scale cultures developing on the Upper Nile in what is now Sudan, but they never have the geographical hinterland to really take that next step towards being a great civilization. So they always remain somewhat subservient to Egypt in the north.
In the ancient Egyptian period, how did, I know, I realize that's obviously a very long period of time, but how did people then understand the Nile? What did they think of it?
Well, it's a very good question. And the ancient Egyptians had no name for the Nile. They simply called it the river. because it was the only river in their world. And they understood that it had its origins beneath a great cavern at the area of the first cataract. And this was because this was where the floodwaters of the Nile first became audible and visible. And so they believed it was divinely sent. It was sent by the gods to water Egypt. And indeed, there's a wonderful religious hymn from the 14th century BC. Which contrasts Egypt with the other countries around it. And it makes the very telling point that Egypt has a Nile, has a river to bring life to the land, whereas in other countries, the river is in the sky. In other words, the rain falls from the sky, whereas in Egypt, the rain comes from the rainwater in the river.
And how well did the people of ancient Egypt actually understand the river and how the river actually worked?
Well, they certainly, by long experience, understood its annual cycle of flood and then receding waters. And they understood that they could harness the power of the Nile to irrigate their fields. They didn't know, for example, where the Nile had its source. As I say, they thought it was in a cavern deep below the first cataract. And we now know that in fact it flows from the Ethiopian highlands and Lake Victoria. But they certainly understood that it was the key to Egypt's life and livelihood, and there are hymns to the River Nile, and they worship the Nile flood as a god of great sort of bountiful generosity.
Do you think there were any downsides to Egypt from being so dependent on this river?
Absolutely there were. So the greatest downside was the unpredictability of the Nile flood. If the Nile flooded at a kind of moderate level, then that brought water to the fields and meant that Egypt would prosper. But if the flood was either too high or too low, it would bring disaster and famine. So if the Nile flood was too high, it would wash away ditches and dikes and breach field boundaries and inundate settlements and fields for too long and would cause famine. And if the Nile flood was too low, the fields would simply not receive the water that they needed for the crops to grow. And again, starvation ensued. So the Egyptians were very conscious of the fact that the Nile was, it could give and it could take away. And the balance between, if you like, bounty and famine was a very, very fine balance.
Was the Nile then reflected in other aspects of Egypt's culture, such as their language and their religion?
Well, what is quite interesting is that although the Nile was so central to the Egyptian way of life, it wasn't by any means the most important god. You might have thought that they would have worshipped the Nile above all else. In fact, they worshipped the sun above all else. And I think that has something to do with the fact that the sun rises and sets every day. So every single day it brings the promise of rebirth and new life when it rises every dawn. Whereas the Nile was just kind of there. It was a constant in their lives. And although they worshipped its flood, its annual inundation as the bringer of fertility, it was perhaps almost taken for granted as something that just existed. And so they didn't tend to invest it with great religious authority. So I suppose it's one of these things that it's important, incredibly important, but it's also so much a part of their daily experience that they almost come to overlook it, if that makes sense.
And the Nile was clearly so important strategically for Egypt. Was it ever battled over?
So certainly control of the river and control of traffic on the river was incredibly important. If you think of, more recent history, for example, and the history of the British Empire, the British Empire was forged essentially to protect trade. And it was the British Navy which allowed a relatively small island off the northwest coast of Europe to develop a worldwide empire. Well, similarly, the Nile was the route to trade between Egypt and the rest of Africa. And so control of the Nile was incredibly important. And we have accounts really throughout history of battles on the Nile, of navies taking part in pitched warfare on the Nile, not to control the Nile per se, but to control its importance as a route for transport and communications.
did it matter which side of the Nile you lived on, or were there bridges and transport across so that the two were fairly interchangeable?
That's an excellent question. Of course, there were no bridges until modern times. But there were and are many, many ferries and small boats that ply from one side of the Nile to the other. So there was certainly always regular traffic and communication across the river. Did it matter which side of the river you lived on? Well, to an extent it did, in that in Egyptian folklore, in Egyptian mythology, the east, where the sun rises, was very much associated with the land of the living, whereas the west, where the sun sets, was the land of the dead. And so in many parts of Egypt, you find the main settlement on the east bank and you find the main cemetery opposite on the west bank. But the other factor is the movement of the river itself. And because the Nile has never been static, it's always kind of swung from east to west across its floodplain over the course of many centuries. You might find that there was only a tiny amount of agricultural land on one bank of the river and a much broader expanse on the other side of the river, in which case, of course, it would make sense to live whichever side had the fields. So you do see a different pattern of settlements as you go the length of the Nile Valley, depending on where the widest area of agricultural land is.
And you say that the Nile moved quite a lot over the years. Did that make it difficult for people who, because there are quite a lot of cities built around the Nile, does that make it difficult for people living in those cities?
Well, we know that cities moved. So, for example, the capital city of Egypt throughout the ancient period, Memphis, moved progressively as the Nile moved within its floodplain. So where Memphis is located now is much further to the east than the ancient city of Memphis. And it simply followed the movement of the river, because what was of critical importance was to be right up against the riverbank for the unloading and loading of barges and trade. So yes, people follow the river, but of course, you know, we're not talking about instantaneous change here. We're talking of change over centuries, and so as settlements sort of develop, they follow the movement of the river.
The Nile being so important to Egypt, was it possible to develop a city away from the Nile, or was really all of Egyptian civilization on the Nile's banks?
Absolutely all of Egyptian civilization was on the Nile banks, and it's only in very recent times, I mean really in the last decade or so, that cities in Egypt have been founded away from the River Nile, and you have these series of new cities that have been built out in the desert, but they're pretty bleak places, and of course they depend ultimately on the river, because they need water supplies like any other city, and that has to be pumped and piped from the river. So in a sense, even though they're physically no longer up on the river bank, they're still dependent upon the River Nile.
Following the end of ancient Egypt, did the Nile's importance decline? Is that one of the reasons why the country was no longer sort of at the forefront of the world, or was it more for other reasons?
I think it's for other reasons, because if you look at Egypt in the Roman period, the Nile is incredibly important, because Egypt is the breadbasket of the Roman Empire, and you have hundreds, if not thousands, of grain ships loading up all along the Nile and then sailing out into the Mediterranean to take their supplies to Rome to feed the imperial capital. So the Nile still remains the lifeline that connects the whole of the country with its export markets. I think the reason why Egypt declines as a power, it's a good question. There are a number of factors, and one can look at more recent developments and say, why is it that countries never stay on top forever? It's something about other countries coming up, being more agile, being more responsive. And of course, in Egypt's case, it also overreached itself in terms of crippling its economies. So perhaps there's a lesson there for more recent history. But the Nile always remains the kind of critical feature in Egyptian history, and enables it, as I say, to communicate with the outside world and also to make the most of its own natural resources.
Clearly, right at the moment, Egypt's in a real state of flux. How do you think the Nile might figure in the country's future?
Well, water and access to water supplies is a major. It's a major factor in Egypt. It's a major factor in many parts of the world. We know that more and more water is being diverted from the Nile further south through a series of dams and also through agriculture within Egypt. And there are major concerns about water supply. And as the population of Egypt grows relentlessly, some estimates are that the population of Egypt is rising by 1 million every 9 months. Those are 1 million extra people that need access to fresh water. So at some point in the not too distant future, water is going to run out or at least become very scarce. So access to the Nile and the Nile's regular flow will be absolutely crucial for the future of Egypt. And of course, in another way too, I mean, the Nile through the Aswan High Dam generates much of Egypt's power. And again, as the population rises, so the demands for electricity grow inexorably. So almost in every way you can think of, whether it's fresh water, whether it's feeding Egypt's population, or whether it's providing electricity, the Nile holds the key to the country's future. And none of the political turmoil that we see on the streets of Cairo today is going to be resolved without proper custodianship of the Nile, because that is the key to Egypt's continued welfare.
I know a lot of people also use the Nile for tourism, and people go on Nile cruises, for example. So if you were to go on a Nile cruise, which parts of Egypt would you want to visit on it?
Well, the answer may be surprising. I would choose actually to visit one of the least visited stretches of the River Nile, which we call Middle Egypt. And that simply signifies that it's kind of in between the two major tourist hotspots of Cairo and Luxor. People are well used to traveling the Nile between Luxor and Aswan down in the south of the country. And of course, there are wonderful monuments along the banks of the river there. But for me, the really magical part of Egypt is the middle stretch between Cairo and Luxor. It's relatively seldom visited by modern tourists. It has some of the most stunning scenery in the whole of Egypt. Wonderful bird life. And is probably the least spoilt stretch of the Nile. So if you want to get a sense of what the Nile looked like and felt like in ancient times, Middle Egypt, past cities like Minya and Malawi and Asyut, is really unbeatable.
That's great, Toby. I think that I've been through the questions I had to ask you. Is there anything else you'd like to cover at all or you wanted to mention?
I think I would simply say that, you know, the Nile, not only through its kind of its presence and its life-giving powers, but through its kind of hold on the Egyptian psyche, is, if you like, the kind of silver thread that runs throughout Egyptian history from the earliest times down to the present day. And I would just encapsulate that in two small kind of facts, really. One is that, you know, we're very accustomed to seeing ancient Egyptian art on tombs and temples. And in fact, that artistic tradition can be traced back thousands of years before recorded history. And the earliest art ever found in Egypt, which is pecked on the rocks overlooking the Nile, is of fishing equipment. And it shows that from the dawn of time, people have not only used the Nile, but they've celebrated the bounty of the Nile in their art. So go back as far as you like, and the Nile is there, central to Egyptian consciousness. And then the other fact, of course, is what's happening today and has happened in the last couple of years since the overthrow of Mubarak. And it's that time and again, the great flashpoints of Egyptian history are by the banks of the Nile, the bridges over the Nile in Cairo. These are the places where pitched battles are being fought between supporters of opposing camps. And it's where people go, literally and metaphorically, to cool off after incidents. So the Nile is there, always has been there. And I think no matter what the future of Egypt, and it certainly looks uncertain, the one thing that the Egyptians know they can depend upon is the Nile. And that gives their life some stability in a very changing and uncertain circumstance.
And that was Toby Wilkinson. The Nile Downriver Through Egypt's Past and Present has just been published by Bloomsbury. Just before we go, here's a reminder that BBC History Magazine is holding two-day events at Bristol's M-Shed on the 15th and 16th of March. We begin with a Vikings Day on Saturday, followed by a First World War Day on the Sunday. In each case, you'll get the chance to hear talks from a range of expert historians and enjoy a buffet lunch. For more information and to find out how to purchase tickets to these events, visit historyextra.com/events. Well, that's almost all for this week. do get in touch with your views by emailing podcast@historyextra.com and we'll do our best to read out some of your messages in future episodes. Don't forget, our March issue is now available in print and digital formats, with features on Henry VIII's court, as seen through the eyes of a long-serving ambassador, Viking dominance of the seas, and the legend of the Long March. You can also keep in touch with us on social media. Follow us on Twitter @HistoryExtra and like us on facebook.com/HistoryExtra. Plus, make sure you visit our website, historyextra.com, for all the latest history news, blogs, image galleries, features, quizzes, and much more. Next week, we'll be finding out about the Nazi women who visited London and taking a sneak preview at a new Viking exhibition at the British Museum. Do join us for that. This History Extra podcast was recorded on location in Bristol and was produced by Jack Fletcher.